Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Hot, windy weather and parched grasslands and forests have provided prime conditions for the wildfires raging across the West. In Utah, 486 blazes so far have scorched over 360,000 acres this year, forcing evacuations, endangering homes and firefighters, and blanketing the state with smoke. So it begs the question, does a warming climate have anything to do with the tinderbox conditions existing in the West? It's a question being posed in the Huffington Post and Time, and today on the program we're taking it up, exploring just what science has to say about the role climate plays in wildfire cycles. Joining me in studio is Michael Jenkins. He's a professor of forest science at Utah State University, and his most recent research includes the effect of bark beetles on forest fuels. And Michael Jenkins, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Jennifer, for inviting me here.
Also with us, Philip Dennison. He is a fire and fuel moisture expert and associate professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Utah. And Philip Dennison, thanks for your time as well.
Thank you.
Later on in the program, we'll take a look at the new look and a deadline that's looming for Utah's Gay Press. But first, fire and climate change. Do you think there's a connection between this year's blazes and climate change? Or do you think wildfire is just Mother Nature's way? Give us a call. Join us at 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Before we get into the particulars of your research, you know, what's been your general reaction to the wildfires raging throughout the West? I mean, did this sort of catch you by surprise like it did many of us? Or as an expert, have you seen this coming for quite some time? Let's start with you, Professor Dennison.
Well, it wasn't that much of a surprise considering that how dry it's been and just seeing all the fuels that are out there ready to burn. So we knew that we were due for a bad fire season at some point in the near future, and it seems like this is our year.
Professor Jenkins?
Well, I think it's just another big fire year. We can go back to big fire years from 1910, the 1930s, Yellowstone in 88, big fires in 2002. So this is another big fire year.
Okay. So is there anything that makes this wildfire year unusual from your vantage point?
No, I don't believe so. It's hot weather, dry fuels, winds. They interact to create the fire behavior that we see. You know, how long are the flames? How fast does the fire spread? How much heat does it give off? Is always a real-time interaction of those elements. Mm.
Can you put some context to this for us? Are there more wildfires now than, say, 20 years ago, 40 years ago? How long have we been tracking this, Professor Dennison?
Well, we have seen more wildfires in the last decade or so, more area burned. This year doesn't seem to be a larger amount of fires or a larger area burned up to this point so far in the year on a national scale. The thing that's unusual about this year that we're really seeing is that we're seeing where fires are occurring. They're occurring near a lot of populated areas, and that's a function of where is really dry right now. We're seeing both the Colorado Front Range, which has a high population, and then also the Wasatch Front, which has a relatively high population. In previous years, we've seen a lot of fires in areas where there aren't as many people, but we seem to have a lot more evacuations this year, a lot more people impacted because of where the fires are burning.
I see. So the fear factor comes from just proximity?
Yeah, proximity. It's what we call the wildland-urban interface. So it's the area where there are homes and there are people, structures that are very close to wildland fuels.
Okay. But Professor Jenkins, you say this is not unusual to see this volume of fires this early in the season?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, it's not unprecedented to have these kind of conditions. It's coupling of the low snowpack, you know, so the snow goes away, the fuels get dry. It's been a fairly windy period this spring, I think, and wind is really public enemy number one for fire behavior. But I think, you know, we can go back and see big fire years almost every decade. The thing is that it's these relatively few big fires that account for most of the damage and loss and most of the money spent. So it's the big fires that get the press, but I don't see it as being especially unusual, no.
Hmm. Well, speaking with Michael Jenkins, he's a professor of forest science at Utah State University, also with us. Philip Dennison, he's an associate professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Utah. And we're talking about this least perceived connection between climate change and fire this season. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Perhaps you saw it, but last week the National Center for Atmospheric Research published a white paper, and they said there are more heat waves than there used to be, there's less rain, and therefore wildfires are what climate change looks like. We'll get to the specifics as we go, but what do you think of that general hypothesis? You know, is this what climate change looks like? Higher, drier, hotter? What do you think, Professor Dennison?
Well, the drier, it's hard to make a case for that, you know, this year or a specifically drier year being specifically blamed on climate change. And what we will see is more extremes. But the warmer is definitely, you know, over time we're seeing an increase in temperature, and that's going to continue. So a year like this year where we had a lower winter snowpack and higher winter temperatures, we ran several degrees above normal for January, February, and March. That's something we're going to see a lot more of in the future.
Okay. Before we go further, do you believe in climate change? And I don't mean that in an ideological sense, but, you know, there is some question that the climate is changing and that humans are contributing to it. Let's just put you on the record for everyone.
Right. So Professor within Dennison. The scientific community, there isn't much of a question. And there are questions about specific feedbacks and specific aspects of climate change. But the vast majority of the scientific community is firmly in the camp that there's very strong evidence for climate change, and that climate change is being caused by increased levels of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
Okay. Just for the skeptics out there, and Professor Jenkins?
Well, I agree with Philip. I'm not a climate scientist per se, but I read the literature, and I agree with the findings of the National Academies of Science worldwide that climate change is real and temperatures are increasing, and we will see more years with less snow, more rain. And given that is the case going forward, then yes, I would expect there would be more big fire years like this.
Okay. Speaking with Michael Jenkins, professor of forest science at Utah State University, and associate professor Philip Dennison from the Department of Geography at the University of Utah. Before we get further, let's kind of drill down into your area of expertise. Let's start with you, Professor Jenkins. Tell us a bit about your research and how climate change is kind of creeping into that research. You study the bark beetle.
Well, I do, and I think there's a more direct link there with what's going on with these large bark beetle outbreaks, and then the fires, a more direct link to warming temperatures for two reasons. First is that increased temperatures will shorten the amount of time it takes these insects to complete their life cycle, so we ultimately have more beetles, let's say. And secondly, the warm, dry conditions reduce the resistance of the host, that is the pine trees, the spruce trees, the Douglas fir, to the beetles. The net effect is greater areas of bark beetle outbreak. These beetles then affect the fuels, they dry the fuels, they create forests that were once green that are now green, yellow, red, all in the same watershed, and that's a very flammable situation. You couple that with dry, low relative humidities, high winds, high temps, and that's a big fire.
Let's back up a little bit. What is the bark beetle? You know, tell us a little bit about
I mean, it's a beetle. It's very small and by itself would be very innocuous, but there are millions and billions of them, and they're native insects, so they are part of the ecosystem, and their role typically is to remove overmature dead trees, recycle those nutrients, and they're kind of a valuable ecologically. But when you have outbreaks occur, so an abundance of host, which is what we have, and that is big old trees, and an abundance of beetles, and that we have partly because of warming temperatures, then you have outbreaks. The outbreaks will go, and 20, 30, 50, 80 years from now, they'll come again, but we're in the midst of one.
And you say the bark beetles are native, so this isn't anything new for fire managers to deal with. How have the bark beetles been managed in the past?
Well, there's two ways to do it. You can either go directly at trying to kill the insects through chemicals, and they certainly are effective for individual trees of high value, say, around the campground, but they're really not suitable for the landscape level management. So what we need to do at the landscape scale is to break up the host type, get a more diversity of species, a greater age class diversity, so young trees, middle-aged trees, old trees, over the landscape scale. And that's a matter of logging and cutting trees, and that's fallen into disfavor with the public recently.
Mm, okay. So the complication now is that the warmer temperatures are allowing the bark beetle to multiply even more, and that results in the outbreak that you mentioned.
Right, and it's very analogous to the wildfire. Once it gets rolling, there's very little we can do. Same is true of a bark beetle outbreak. Once it gets rolling in suitable host, it goes until the host is eliminated. We need to impose, both from a wildfire perspective and a beetle management perspective, we need to impose treatments in advance of the outbreaks, in advance of the ignitions.
Is it possible?
Yes, it's absolutely possible.
So the infestation has not gone to such lengths that we can't contain it.
No, I'm saying this infestation will run its course, but we need to impose treatments on the landscape that will short-circuit the outbreak that might occur 10, 20, 50, 80 years from now.
Hmm. Speaking with Professor Michael Jenkins, a professor of forest science at Utah State University. Also with us, Philip Dennison, a fire and fuel moisture expert, an associate professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Utah. Professor Dennison, what in the world is fuel moisture?
So fuel moisture is the water content of fuels. So if you take some grass, let's say some grass that's very green and moist, it'll contain quite a bit of water. It might contain as much water as there is dry material within the grass. But as that grass kind of starts to turn brown and dry down, it loses a lot of its water content. And water content, acts as a heat sink, and that will take the fire and kind of damp it down. So fire will spread much more slowly through wet fuels, or it may not spread at all through very moist fuels, whereas dry fuels, it will spread much more readily.
Okay, so when we talk about fuel, we're talking about grasses.
We're talking about grasses. We're talking about wood from shrubs and trees. We're talking about leaves, anything that's material that can burn.
I understand you look primarily at fire on the range, sort of these lower elevations.
Yeah, rangelands, shrublands. We look at everything from grasses up to sagebrush, juniper.
And how much of Utah fits into this category of rangeland?
Quite a bit of it. So all of the lower elevations within Utah.
So what does the fuel moisture look like in Utah's rangeland right now?
It's quite dry. So we had very dry conditions in May and especially in June, and high temperatures and high winds. And that really was effective in drying out a lot of the grasses. And then also some of the fuels that are green and live still, but have much lower moisture. So for example, sagebrush is one indicator that we use to determine fire danger. And somewhere in the percent range of 80 to 65% moisture content is where we would say that the sagebrush is more susceptible to burning. And we might usually, in a normal year or an average year, see that somewhere around August or September. And this year, we're already there. We were there in the middle part of June.
Hmm. How do you measure that?
Usually it's sampled. So someone goes out and takes a sample and then brings it back and dries it and then compares it to the wet weight and the dry weight to find out how much moisture was there. But my lab is working on trying to find ways to measure this remotely. So we use satellite data, and we're also using soil moisture stations to try and come up with ways of mapping and remotely measuring fuel moisture.
Speaking with Philip Dennison, he's a fire and fuel moisture expert, a professor at the University of Utah. Also with us, Professor Michael Jenkins. He is a professor at Utah State University. And we're talking about wildfire and if there's any link between the frequency and the intensity that we've seen this year and climate change. If you'd like to join us, what do you want to know about parched grasslands and dry forests? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We need to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Wildfires this year have made headlines from Alaska to North Carolina. And of course, closer to home, the tragic fire in Colorado Springs claimed 348 homes. And wildfires have scorched nearly 360,000 acres here in Utah. So who or what is to blame? Some say climate change is creating the dry, hot conditions that make blazes inevitable. Today on the program, we're seeing if there's any scientific truth to that claim. Joining us in studio, Professor Michael Jenkins from Utah State University and Associate Professor in the Department of Geography, Philip Dennison from the University of Utah. And we invite you to join us as well. Is this just one bad fire year, or do you see it's a consequence of a warming climate? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. So what do you think about that question? You know, is this the consequence of a warming climate or just one bad year? Professor Jenkins, what do you think?
Well, I've said before, I think it's a bad year, but not unlike others. I don't think it's unprecedented at all. These temperatures are not warmer than other big fire years. It's always hot, windy, dry in the big fire years. I think, the low snowpack, we've had years like that before. I mean, would we have been having this discussion last year when it rained all through June? I mean, was that an unusual year? You know, perhaps not. That's just a wet year. So I don't, like I've said, see this as being especially unusual. I can see projections forward with the climate change scenario being more years like this. So we're going to lengthen the fire season. There'll be more days in the fire season, more periods within, say, the diurnal period where fires can burn more intensely. If what the climate change scientists say is true, then I can see that scenario playing out over the decades to come.
Is that the way you see it too, Professor Dennison?
Yeah, and we do already see some studies that have shown that that the fire season is getting longer. Over the last couple of decades, that because of decreased snowpack, and earlier snowmelt, that we are seeing that there's been an extension of the fire season. It's starting earlier in the year. And to the extent that this year we have started the fire season relatively early compared to past years, that yes, this is something that we will see more frequently as we go into the future.
Among scientists, in the circles that you guys run in, I mean, are people talking about climate change, or is this kind of a no-brainer? Like, the rest of us seem to be obsessed with climate change, but I'm wondering if you guys are also talking about the effects of climate change on, you know, the next 100 years. Professor Dennison?
Yeah, we definitely talk about it a lot, and I think that it's something that we all think about in our research, at least within my department. But it's something that we look at the longer term, and I think it's something that sometimes lost a little bit on the public, is that every time there's a heat wave, all the people who are trying to send their climate change message, they say, I told you so.
Right.
And then when there's a snowstorm, then all the people who are climate change deniers will say, see, I told you so about that. And we really need to get away from that and look at the long term. So what are the trends that we're seeing over decadal timescales? And for me and my colleagues, when we look at those long timescales, we definitely see the impacts of climate change, and we anticipate them still occurring in the future and getting worse in the future.
Professor Jenkins, I mean, is it hype partly, or?
Well, I work at an ag school in northern Utah, so you can imagine there's a mixed opinion about climate change there. But I'm also within a college of natural resources, where I would guess that 100% of my colleagues agree with the science and believe that climate change is real. I don't think it's hype at all. I think it's real, and it's coming, and that it will have an effect on fires in the future.
Talking about the connection between climate change and the fires that we're seeing, the wildfire season, if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's go to the phones, and Sergio is joining us from North Salt Lake. Sergio, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I'm glad to hear your programming. I think my opinion is the ecosystem has been affecting, and the Amazons, due to the cutting of all the wood, all the trees. And some companies, they don't realize that they are depleting the ecosystem and the Amazons. Therefore, we don't have that protection, that layer of protection that we didn't have before.
An interesting idea. Thanks, Sergio, for the call. It seems that Sergio's asking about logging in the rainforest and the effect that that is having on the climate. Do you see any connection there, gentlemen? Professor Dennison?
I'm not really an expert on the Amazon, so I can't speak to that. But I do know that there are lots of concerns about the Amazon and climate and potential feedbacks there.
Mm-hmm.
It's there's two elements to that. You know, the removal of the trees and the benefits that trees provide and cleaning the atmosphere, producing oxygen, moderating the climate is important. But then also it's kind of a slash and burn system where they're wanting to remove the trees to create fields for agriculture. So they're burning, and then that's contributing to the carbon in the atmosphere. So it's a two-pronged thing there. And certainly that is an important element down there. The deforestation in tropical regions is an important influence on all this.
Mm-hmm. Sergio, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We spoke briefly, Professor Jenkins, about the bark beetle infestation that we're seeing. Is that primarily here in the West, or is it throughout the country?
Well, bark beetles are mostly the ones that are causing us problems are Western species, and they occur in Western conifer forest, kind of from the Rocky Mountains through the coast ranges, so it's more of a Western issue.
Mm-hmm. Do you see that other bug infestations are occurring in other parts of the country?
Yes, I think anytime you have conditions that allow the insect numbers to increase and the host resistance to decrease, there's a potential for outbreaks to occur. One of the bigger issues perhaps we have are non-native species that get introduced from Europe, Asia, wherever through commerce or accidentally otherwise, that can be really difficult problems because they get entered into the system without those agents that tend to control them where they're native.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, gypsy moths and a whole variety of cheatgrass is an invasive species, which really contributes to the fire cycle in the West, as Philip would know from it's a rangeland issue and, just an abundance of non-native species that are wreaking havoc.
You're nodding your head, Professor Dennison.
Yes, so cheatgrass and other invasive grasses are a major issue within the Great Basin because they accelerate the fire cycle. So what will happen is the cheatgrass will invade fairly sparsely within an area of sagebrush, let's say. But that will connect the fuels together so that the fire can easily spread from one part of the range to another, connecting all the sagebrush together. Once the sagebrush is killed, then the cheatgrass comes back, but the sagebrush doesn't come back as rapidly. And we end up having a lot more fire because the cheatgrass burns much more easily.
Hmm. When we have a hot, dry season like we have right now, and we have a lot of wildfire, what is the byproduct? What is the consequence of that on the environment for years to come? You study the rangelands, Professor Dennison. So, what effect does wildfire have when it's on such a large scale on, the sagebrush and the wildlife?
Well, the first thing to realize is that fire is a natural part of most ecosystems in the West. So, there is a historic precedent for areas burning, and the areas will burn, and that is part of their natural cycle. What we're yet worried is when we have fires that come in rapid succession that can change the vegetation type. And we end up converting a lot of areas that were previously one type of vegetation to another, and often provides a route for invasive species to get in. And the other place we really, really worry is where we have these fires close to people. So when we have to evacuate a lot of people, when we have homes destroyed, when we have people's lives disrupted, and that's another big cause for concern.
And the wildfires in Utah have claimed one life, certainly not the extent of the property damage that we've seen elsewhere in the country, but the fire season is still alive and well right here in Utah. Professor Jenkins, what's the net effect for a forest of a fire? I mean, fire is part of the ecological process, but I mean, when you have lots of wildfire, what effect does that have on the forest health?
I think the urban interface issue notwithstanding, and the horrible human tragedy of people losing homes and their lives. But from an ecological point of view in Western forests, big fires are the norm. They've happened historically for, since the Pleistocene, 13,000 years or more. And I think, you know, from that perspective, I would almost say the more fires, the better, because it rejuvenates the forest. It creates this diversity that we need in both age class and species diversity, breaks up the potential for fires in the future, creates fire breaks, creates places where suppression forces can kind of get to create some defensible space. And, you know, big forest fires in wildernesses are mostly a good thing. I think the benefits far outweigh the negative impacts for a timber forest fire in a wilderness, let's say.
Mm. What about the wildlife that calls the forest home?
Many animals benefit from big fires. It creates the diversity that they need, that gives them the hiding cover. The browse, you know, it's hard for them to eat a big old plant, but you burn this plant, you know, like the fire in Alpine next year, that'll be wall-to-wall gamble oak suckers, and they're much more succulent to the animals, but it creates the mosaic that allows them places for thermal cover, for hiding cover, and yet the browse they need. So the more diverse, the better. It's kind of a generalization, I know, but I think ecologically, fire's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. It does make a difference, though, when you see the fire, the smoke on the horizon. I mean, when you see it with your eyes, and part of that has to do with, you know, people living a lot closer to nature these days. Professor Dennison?
Yeah, I think a good example would be the fires that we've had recently down in Harriman or out towards Saratoga Springs or even Alpine. 20 or 30 years ago, there wouldn't have been very many people out there, and it really wouldn't have been much of an issue as far as the people goes. But, you know, today that we have a lot more homes out there, and there's a lot more that's at risk in those areas.
Mm-hmm. Speaking with Philip Dennison, he's a professor, an associate professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Utah, and also with us, Michael Jenkins, professor of forest science at Utah State University. And we're talking about this link between wildfire and climate change. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. So we're in this brave new world where, the winters are a little bit shorter and drier, and the fire season is a little bit longer. What do we do? I mean, how do we as humans adjust to a lengthier fire season? What do you think, Professor Dennison?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily characterize the winters as drier, but definitely less snowfall or less snowpack. And I think that that's going to have a big impact on the amount of water that's retained, both for soil moisture, which is important for plants, but also what we get for our reservoirs. The runoff is going to be much more rapid in a shorter period earlier in the spring than we would see where the snowpack slowly melts over a longer time, and that runoff coming later in the spring and into the summer. So there's definitely some impacts on water availability, on what we'll have for water resources. For vegetation, we're going to see that it's going to be drying out likely earlier in some years. And then we're going to see that our fire season is going to start earlier, like it did this year. And that's not going to happen every year, but we're going to see it be more frequent over time as we go into the next several decades.
We touched on this earlier in the hour, but Professor Jenkins, you know, how can we as humans better manage the forests to sort of deter the fires that are inevitable?
Well, if you look at those things that contribute to the fire, the fuels, weather, topography, what do we have any control over? Well, it's only the fuels, and we need to manage fuels. And the Healthy Forest Restoration Act of 2002, passed under the Bush administration after a big fire year in 2001, provided legislation and funding to deal with hazardous fuels. And we need more money, more effort, more public support for managing the fuels in advance of the ignition. And not just around the interface, you know, the defensible space around a town is well and good, but when you have a big fire roaring out of the forest backed by a strong wind, there's no amount of defensible space that's going to keep it out of that community. So we need to find out where the ignitions occur, where the fires that threaten communities come from, which way the winds are blowing, and get out there and manage fuels and create avenues whereby forces, firefighting forces, can get to these ignitions. Because it's always been in fire suppression that it's best to attack the fire while it's small. Mm-hmm. That simultaneously minimizes costs and losses. It's safest, it's easiest. So we need to find out where these ignitions happen, modify the fuel so that the fire stays small, and allow forces to get in there to keep these fires in the wilderness, because once they get back by the wind and start going towards the communities, it's not much we can do.
When you say manage fuels, though, I mean, are you talking about removing dead trees? What exactly does that
mean? That's part
of
it. It's removing dead trees. It's changing the composition, you know, species conversion from flammable fuels to non-flammable fuels. We have excessive fuel loads in most of our forests. We need to reduce those fuel loads. Prescribed fire is a way to do that, but with the issues surrounding smoke, it's less popular, and perhaps it, you know, violates air quality legislation, so it's not possible. But we can do that mechanically, but it can only happen if we put the same amount of effort into this program as we do into the suppression program. There's an unlimited amount of money available once the ignition begins, and very limited amount of money for what we call pre-suppression, all those things we should do in advance of the ignition.
Hmm. Back to the lowly bark beetle. You said we're right in the middle of this infestation. How long will it take to run its course? How long will they keep killing trees and providing this fuel?
The mortality, I think it's peaked, and probably, you know, I'm guessing in most forests and most types within 10 years, we'll be worrying about something else. The trees will be dead. The fuels will be on the ground. The fire hazard will be much reduced until we get 10, 20, 30 years in the future when the big dead trees start falling over, creates more fuel, creates difficulties for firefighters, makes it more difficult to control fire lines, to get access. These big dead trees are hazardous to the public, to the firefighters. But that's 10, 20, 30 years post-outbreak.
Okay. All of this stuff takes money, so that goes back to policymakers. But if you had your wish as an expert in fires, so what would you recommend be done to keep fires at bay?
I would recommend a big investment in hazardous fuel programs within agencies and communities. I think that's where the only element that we can really manage it all.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Dennison, what's the outlook for from your vantage point?
I think that management definitely needs to improve, and there are several benefits there. And the money spent up front on fuels management can help reduce the amount of money that's spent on fighting fires. And you only have to fight them where really there's critical resources that are endangered. But the other thing is it can also help in other areas. For example, with fuel moisture, if you thin out vegetation, there's more soil moisture available for a smaller number of trees or plants, then you will increase fuel moisture, which will help reduce fire spread. And it also can help with bark beetle attacks, if I'm not mistaken, is that if you do some thinning, then the trees can pitch out the beetles and defend themselves a little bit better.
Hmm. So what I'm hearing both of you say, we need to start acting now so that as the climate warms a little bit, we can avert disaster.
We really need to start acting decades ago, but you know, now would be good, yes.
Now would be good. Professor Jenkins?
I agree. I agree with Philip totally. You know, we should have been doing it. It's not that agencies don't want to do this or don't understand this. They certainly do. It's the money thing, you know, and this is a congressional deal. Until we get public support for that and the money becomes available, there's not much to be done. But we have the knowledge. We have the skill. We just need the funds.
Michael Jenkins, a professor of forest science at Utah State University. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
And Philip Dennison, a fire and fuel moisture expert and associate professor at the University of Utah. And Professor Dennison, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Up next, a turning point for Utah's gay press. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCBW, Salt Lake City.